This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Kidnappers, a volunteer-based community access station. For more information, go to www.radiokidnappers.org.nz. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this program available through funding the Access Internet Radio Project.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine.
You're listening to Radio Kidnappers, the voice of Hawke's Bay, and I'm Lynn Trafford, presenting on behalf of the Hawke's Bay branch of the Royal Society of New Zealand, Hawke's Bay Scientists on Air. This program is your opportunity to get to know practicing and recently retired scientists from around the bay. With me in the studio, I have civil engineer Arthur Budvitas. Having worked in Samoa, Tonga, Fiji, Solomon Islands, Papua New Guinea, United States, Canada, Australia and New Zealand, today we will find out how he came to live in Hawke's Bay and became chairman of the local branch of IPENS, the Institute of Professional Engineers in New Zealand. So welcome to Hawke's Bay Scientists on Air, Arthur Budvitas.
Thank you, Lynn.
It's lovely to have you with us. Now, I happen to know, Arthur, that you are not a local Hawke's Bay boy.
No, definitely not.
Where are you
not.
From?
I was born in Canada, in Ottawa, Ontario. Yeah, moved to New Zealand when I was 10 years old, but my first 10 years of life were in Ottawa.
Where did you go to school in New Zealand?
When I first arrived in New Zealand, I started at Mount Albert Primary School, then moving to Kōwhai Intermediate, and then finally Mount Albert Grammar School.
Aha, so that's all in Auckland.
All in Auckland, all in Mount Albert. I followed Rob Muldoon from school to school.
Did you indeed?
And we actually wrote to him when we were students, asking him to write back. I think that was in Form 2 while he was still Prime Minister.
So. And did he?
He did. He wrote back. I still have a copy of the letter on file at home.
Good. That's nice to hear these little things, isn't it? Now, when you were at school, maybe at secondary school, was there an awakening moment when you thought, by Joves, I think I'd really like to be an engineer when I'm a big boy and leave school?
Actually, it wasn't even at high school. According to my parents, I said when I was 4 years old, I'm going to be a civil engineer when I grow up.
Because you liked building bridges out of bricks or what?
To be honest, I built a lot with Lego. Lego, the tool for everybody. Mm-hmm. But apparently I just got this idea in my head that civil engineering was for me. And I've never, ever changed from that, from a brief time in my early teens when I said, I'm going to be a beach bum.
Oh, right. Well, you could do both, probably. One in the summer holidays and one for the whole rest of the year while you were studying. Civil engineering, where did you do your degree?
I went to Auckland University, so I was at the engineering school there. Went straight from high school. I skipped seventh form, having got my A bursary in sixth form. And instead of going back to high school and wasting a year getting a scholarship, I said, it's time to go to university.
Get on with it.
So straight off to university I went and had my intermediate year at Auckland University, and then my three professional years, again, at Auckland University.
And civil it was.
Civil from the beginning. Obviously, the intermediate year is a bit general, but
yes.
Once I got past that, it was all civil engineering. Not quite structures where I've ended up, but it was a broad base in civil engineering anyway. So.
Yeah, mix of stuff. So when you finished your degree, did you have an exciting first job afterward? It's quite important, that first job, I think.
Well, actually, yeah, it was my first job actually took a while. When I finished university, it was the summer, the end of 91, beginning of 92, and there was no work around. And in fact, at that stage, only four of my classmates out of 80 of us in civil engineering got jobs.
Oh, no.
So I actually said, right, I'm going to go back to university. And so I spent several years pretending to do a master's degree in coastal engineering, which I never finished. It was computer modeling, and at the time I was on an old VAX VMS system.
Yeah.
And I was programming in Fortran, working with an American software verifying its applicability, and suddenly along came Windows 95, and everything I'd done was
out of date.
So I said, stuff it. But during that period, I was fortunate enough to have a friend who worked for a small engineering firm in Auckland, CLC Consulting Group, and they had a part-time job, so 2 days a week. They needed someone to come in and work on their smaller house projects.
So you were quite lucky, really, then?
I was incredibly lucky.
Yeah.
I this friend of mine who worked for an associated geotechnical firm said, yeah, I know somebody who's desperate for work. He's a good guy, good work habits. He talked me up nicely. And
he didn't know about the beach bum bit, did he?
No.
He can't have known about that bit.
No. But, yes, so it was a good beginning to my career. I worked for a very clever engineer, a man called Kelvin Cooper, who I still look up to as an engineer now. Also in the firm as a partner was a man called Ernest Lapish, who has had a lot to do with developing New Zealand building codes. And again, a lot of respect for Ernest still. I think he's still around. I don't believe he's fully retired yet.
So it was a good foundation for
you to
build on.
It was a very solid foundation.
Having got that foundation in place then, you skived off back to Canada.
Yes.
Was this kind of a finding one's route experiment, or why did you go to Canada?
At that point, I was married. My eldest son was 3 years old at the time. And we decided it was time to go do our overseas experience. I'd gotten married at 20 while I was still at university. And, yeah, I hadn't done much. I hadn't done much traveling, although I'd been from Canada to New Zealand. I hadn't done any traveling as an adult. So I decided, yep, it was time to go overseas. I picked somewhere easy to go, Canada.
Well, it's kind of like going home, isn't it, for you?
Kind of, although it was a surprising culture shock. Kiwis are very earthy people, and Canada, I think because of the cold, tend to be very reserved, quiet people. So it was a bit of a cultural adjustment, even being Canadian, going back to Canada.
Uh-huh.
Fortunately, I did have a very solid grounding in engineering to take with me, although at first I was trying to get out of engineering and become a... What was I trying to do? I was trying to get into programming and the internet. Unfortunately, I had no background and no skills. So after 2 months of unsuccessfully being unemployed, although enjoying a great Canadian summer, I said, right, it's time to be an engineer again. 2 days later, I was working.
Yeah, that's much better. One should stick to one's knitting.
Yes, absolutely.
One, really, particularly when changing countries. I think you were very fortunate in Canada to work on a wide variety of engineering projects. Are there one or two that sort of stick in your mind as being really special?
Well, when I was in Canada, initially I was working for a consulting firm, and one of my most memorable projects was a large retirement village. Obviously, with aging populations, those were becoming a fairly big need for people to build. So we were doing two four-story towers with a large complex in between of gardens and underground car park. And it was unfortunately a very bad soil site. But at the time, I learned how snow drifts work. We had to design for up to 7 meter deep snow drifts on top of the car park building between the two towers.
And we in Napier can't quite sort of come to grips with that kind of design.
I still have problems coming to grips with 7 meters of snow. It's an incredibly deep amount of snow.
And snow is so heavy and so wet.
Exactly. And on top of poor soils, it was a very big challenge. We had to pile the building to 25 meters deep for some of it, and then some of it was sitting on a different part of the ground with fancy separation details between it. But it was an interesting project because some of it was concrete with big steel piles, some of it was timber framed. Yeah, and
good
then
learning.
Again, learning about snow.
Were you able to use what you learned there for the rest of your time in Canada? Just a one-off thing?
It was a one-off thing. It was only a short period I worked in the consulting firm, and then I was lucky enough to get a job with the National Research Council of Canada working in the Canadian Hydraulic Centre. So that was a sudden jump from applied designing things to research.
Yes.
So it was a sudden massive shift in what I was doing, but it was getting back to an earlier love because I'd always loved fluid mechanics and coastal processes, and then working for the Hydraulic Centre, it's exactly what I was doing. I was building models of coastlines, of ports, breakwaters, and getting to play with large bits of equipment that I'd never ever seen before, working with a team of very skilled engineers and scientists. And that was for nearly 6 years.
Working for an organization like that, was there quite a bit of publicity, publicizing what you were doing? Were you writing, or was it not that kind of a role?
What I was doing, our research center was actually about a year before I started with them, became a cost recovery unit for the government.
Oh,
so we actually
really?
Had to fully fund ourselves out of projects. So it became quite a shift for them as a paradigm, having to find research projects that people would be willing to pay for.
To pay for. It's always hard, isn't it?
So providing papers became a bit of a difficulty because, of course, these are now private projects that somebody is making money out of.
Yeah.
And it's there's proprietary information happening, or it's part of a design for someone else where they need something verified. And back then, computer models still were not particularly sophisticated. So when we're doing a model of a port with three or four ships in it, how the ships move and interact with each other just couldn't at that time be done with computer modeling. It still has problems now, I understand.
But even more so back then. Because we're talking, what, about the early 2000s, that kind of period.
Yeah, so that was
1999
to 2004,
right,
basically.
Yeah.
So although we had very sophisticated computer software to run the wave machines, we couldn't do the computer models that would tell us where the waves went.
Yeah.
Well, even today, we still, there's still challenges. Physical modeling is still done.
Uh-huh. I'm glad to hear that, because I think that's the sexy part of engineering. Really.
Oh,
I
do
quite
too.
Like to see
I loved the lab was a great opportunity because, of course, everybody got involved. So
yes.
If there was a model to be built, the head scientist on the project to the technicians, we'd all be down on the floor pouring concrete, making the shapes of the seafloor.
Making it work.
And then filling it with sand and putting boat models together. So I spent a lot of time learning about, I learned more about concrete, I think, pouring concrete, than I ever did at university. So it was a lot of fun and very interesting, five and a half years.
Good.
I think some of my most memorable projects were some of the oil platform work we did. We had one project that came back six or seven different times as the project engineers and the owners developed their concepts. So we went from a oil platform that was based in the off the coast of Canada that was going to be relocated to the Sakhalin Sea, where the waves were much bigger, much higher, much more vicious seas. And we had to look at things like wave overtopping and wave impacts and how to protect the crew and the equipment on the top of the oil platform from being damaged by the waves.
To me, this sounds like you did some really super-duper stuff.
It was fantastic stuff. We'd run models that were, we'd have 10, 15 variations of the model. We'd run them 10 times each to verify the statistics.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
We'd have each test would be half an hour, which would be the equivalent of, 2 days real time. But we're scale models, so the time frame changed down. Mm-hmm. And we'd have anywhere up to 300 sensors across the towers and equipment to let us know what was going on in the model.
So, Arthur, why did you skive off and go to the Pacific Islands?
Well,
was there something really exciting that was going to happen in the Pacific Islands?
No,
or was
actually,
it kind of an accident?
The Pacific Islands itself was an accident. After 5 years with the lab, I found that my career was actually stalling. Unfortunately, because I hadn't had the master's degree, I hadn't done a PhD, career advancement was going to require at least a master's degree and preferably a PhD. I wasn't going to be able to do that easily in Canada while working full-time with a family. So I said, right, it's time to do something different. And I actually took my bosses and said, would you consider helping me get a PhD? And they said, oh, no, it's not worth the trouble. I said, okay, fine, I'm off.
And
I was aiming for New Zealand because I'd grown up here.
You got sidetracked.
I saw this job ad for Tonga, and it happened to be the first job that somebody offered me a contract for. And I think initially I didn't get the job. Somebody else had already applied and been granted it before my CV was even seen. And then 2 weeks later I got a phone call saying, oh, would you still be interested? The guy fell through. He didn't want to move to Tonga. And I said, absolutely.
Good on
Six
you.
6 weeks after that I was in Tonga.
Kingdom of Tonga, here we come. And whilst you're in the Pacific, I'm just going to read out some of these projects and then maybe you can tell us a wee bit more to fill in the gaps for them. You oversaw the buildings of meeting houses, jetties, wharves, schools, community centres, churches, retail complexes over and over again. Good stuff that really has a heavy social impact on the communities that you were working with, which you don't always get with a car park building. But with this kind of thing in a Pacific Island, huge impacts. Did you enjoy the time there?
I did. I loved my time in the Pacific Islands, both Tonga and Samoa. Tonga was an interesting challenge, having moved straight from Canada, where at the time when I left Canada, I think it was minus 36 degrees when I left for the airport, to arriving in Tonga at plus 36 degrees. It, just straight the shift, but then moving into cyclones. Although in my initial career, I'd looked at cyclones once or twice, dealing with cyclones on a real thing was a huge eye-opener. And realizing that people just didn't want to build properly was another big eye-opener.
Yes.
One day I plan to write a book, How Not to Do It, My Experience in the Islands. Yeah. I've got a couple of hundred photos that I'm sure somebody will love at some point. So one day there will be a book.
I think you should do that, Arthur. I think you should do that. Did you have a particular pet project, something that you look back and think, by Joves, I'm really, really pleased we did that?
I think one of my one of my most emotional projects was a project on Nuuatapatapu Island. It's a small island which, from the main island of Tonga, is almost all the way up to Samoa. It was a high school project that was being funded by New Zealand Aid. The old high school had been started. It was built badly by the builder at the time, and then the firm I worked for got hired to assess the project and then add additional buildings and upgrade the existing ones to a decent cyclone standard. Weeks before the project finished, I had a technician on the island with his family. Weeks after he'd finished on the island and hopped on the ferry to come back to the mainland, that ferry sank. Contact with the island became very hard to get because there was no phones, satellite phone. I think there was two on the whole island. And the ferry only went there once a month. So anything up to the island was difficult. And then, of course, a year later, there was the tsunami that devastated Samoa that had also hit Nuuatapatapu. And the entire town that I remembered was more or less gone. And one of the few things left standing was the high school, which was on a high hill just out of town.
You must have been pleased about that.
I was very happy to see the high school still there. It had been used as an emergency shelter, so it was an incredibly important part of the island life from that point on.
Yeah.
And on this island, I mean, there was no electricity most of the time. They had a generator that ran half an hour a day. A few people had private generators, but on the whole, power was not there. Water was done when the power generator was on. The water tanks filled up, and that was the only time of day you got water as well, apart from rainwater from your own private tank. So it was an incredible difference seeing how that part of the world lives to what, you know, I'd been used to in New Zealand and Canada.
Yeah, no snowdrifts.
No snowdrifts, but lack of water and...
Water is vital, isn't it?
Oh, it's incredibly so.
I mean, you built jetties and wharves, so there's water there again. But you also did water projects.
We did a few water projects. The Ha'ano water project was a New Zealand Aid-funded project after a series of typhoid cases had come out in Tonga. And it was a two-part project. One was providing a large water tank, which was done by another firm, although we supervised the construction of it, and then teaching the village to make water tanks for themselves. So each house would end up with somewhere between a 5 and 10,000 litre water tank that would then be supplied with water off their roofs. So teaching the village how to build a concrete water tank. And at the time, water tanks were costing, you know, I think it was 4,000 pa'anga, which was three times the national average income. These people were doing it for 1,000 to 1,500. So a huge difference in providing water for themselves.
And a huge difference also to the community to be able to have this resource right there at their doorstep.
Very much so. And my protege at the time in the firm, he actually lived in that village. So watching him come to work every day, having been on site, and at the end when the handover happened, the tears of joy from the village for having clean water were just heartrending. It's not something I've ever experienced. I don't know if I can ever really explain it, but seeing people so happy to have something so simple.
Or something we take for granted.
Absolutely.
So much.
You know, we think water just comes out of the tap, and these people didn't.
You've mentioned a couple of times that these projects that you worked on or in association with were aid projects.
A lot of the work I did in the island was aid projects.
So where does the aid come from? Is it government funded or is it social services funded?
Usually it was government funded, so it was a variety of New Zealand Aid, Australian Aid, the ADB, the Asian Development Bank, and the World Bank funded a lot of those projects. Now that wasn't all of them. I mean, a lot of the church projects, you mentioned meeting houses, those are meeting houses for the Latter-day Saints Church. So they funded their own projects,
of course,
out of the worldwide funds, and I think at one point it looked like they were going to have a meeting house in every village in Tonga and Samoa was their eventual goal.
Gosh.
So, yeah, it was an interesting thing. They were by far the best built buildings.
Yeah.
And I know in Samoa, after Cyclone Evan came through, there were several meeting houses that had actually been in construction that were being used as shelters. And we had to wait until people could move back out of them before we could finish the project. You know, the roof was on, the walls were up, but it wasn't a finished job.
No.
And people were sheltering in it because it was the only shelter available.
That's great, isn't it?
It's nice to be able to know that you've done that.
Exactly. And they were standing simply because they had been
that well-built,
constructed according to modern methodology.
Absolutely. And yeah, they'd been built not just to modern methodologies, but somebody actually watched to make sure every nail was actually
put in. It was built properly. Oh, dear. Goodness gracious. So you were in the islands for a decade.
Yes.
And then you came back to New Zealand. That's another big move for you, wasn't it? A huge move to go from Canada to the islands, and another move? Or was it simply time?
It was time. 10 years in the islands. My contracts were coming to an end in the islands. Again, I'd worked with a very good team of people across the Pacific for one firm that put me in most of the Pacific nations. And then, yeah, my contract came to an end, so it was time to move on.
Did you come straight to the Bay? Or?
I applied for work from Samoa.
Oh, okay.
And as I was applying for jobs, I said, okay, not Auckland. And the placement firm immediately sent me three interviews. I had job offers for Hawke's Bay, Palmerston North, and Wellington. And I took an immediate poll of everybody, every Kiwi I could find in Samoa, and said, which one of these three? I don't know any of them. I've been to Wellington, but that's all I can say. And every one of them, including all the Wellingtonians, said Hawke's Bay.
You'd be a fool. So that's how it happened. It was a raffle kind of thing, a bit of like a bingo night.
It was. I mean, if I hadn't accepted any of those three contracts, the next interview was for a job in Timaru. So
we're very pleased, Arthur, that we have you here in the Bay. What sorts of things, since you've arrived here and you came here, the end of 2014, what's been going on for you since you came to the Bay?
The firm I work for, Structural Concepts Limited, we do actually very little work in Hawke's Bay, although we've been involved in a number of strengthening projects. The building we're in was strengthened. The strengthening design was done by my firm, by my boss. I've personally done three or four smaller strengthening projects along Emerson Street. But a lot of our work is elsewhere than Hawke's Bay. So I've done projects in Christchurch. I've currently got several big projects in Gisborne, including a job for PGG Wrightson, which is in works. It's operating now. It's a seed drying plant. Construction was finished more or less on time, and they're just doing the last little bits of commissioning now for a fully operating seed drying plant.
It's a good thing to do. Interesting.
Absolutely.
Whilst all this was going on with your work day, you also became quite involved with IPENS.
Yes. 3 weeks after I arrived in the country, I arrived in the country on a Sunday, and I started work on Monday. So 3 weeks after that, Guy Lethbridge, my predecessor with the branch, actually emailed my boss saying, I've had enough of being branch chair. It's been 5 years. I need a successor. Gary, would you do it? And Gary immediately emailed me and said, Arthur,
this is a job for you.
I think you should do this. And with only 3 weeks into the country, I thought I'd better meet some people, get to know the community a little bit better. So I said, sure, why not? And also 3 weeks into a job, how do you say no when your boss says, will you do this?
You have to do it, don't you really? We have also interviewed Guy Lethbridge on Hawke's Bay Scientists on Air, and anyone listening would be able to find his interview, I'm sure. So that's interesting. You didn't know that I had done that. So that's the role with IPENS. And since that time, you have received some other qualifications, have you?
I was fortunate enough at the beginning of the month to finally receive my Chartered Professional Engineering status. So it's the recognition of my professionalism and capabilities as an engineer by my industry, to say that, yes, you're a good person, you're able to sign off and supervise projects on your own.
They gave you a tick.
They gave me the tick.
Arthur Bidvitas, on behalf of the Hawke's Bay branch of the Royal Society of New Zealand and of Radio Kidnappers, thank you for being my guest on Hawke's Bay Scientists on Air. To find out more about civil engineering degrees in New Zealand or the role of IPNs, the work engineers are currently doing in the Pacific, a Google search will be a good starting point. Similarly, to find out more about the Royal Society of New Zealand or the Royal Society in Hawke's Bay, Google will answer a lot of your questions. Please join me on Monday mornings at 9:30 to meet another practicing or recently retired scientist. I'm Lynn Trafford.
This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Kidnappers, a volunteer-based community access station. For more information, go to www.radiokidnappers.org.nz. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this program available through funding the Access Internet Radio Project.